My name's Jerry Jones, and I'm an alcoholic. Sober by the grace of God since January of 1973, and I'm delighted to be here. I'm many things. I always tell people this because it helps identify who I am and what I am. I'm the adult spouse of an Al-Anon. I can say that with some freedom tonight because she's not here. That's And I went to an Al-Anon meeting today, and I find that they have a different first step than we do. They read it. They disclosed it right in the middle of the meeting. They said, "We are powerless over Al-Anons." God identified with that. I really did. I felt pretty good when I got here. A lot of times they have a little sign on the front of the podium that says, "For the grace of God," but for the grace of God, that's where they... This is the only place I've ever been where they have a hangman's noose. They have a hangman. It doesn't have quite... It's supposed to have 13 wraps around it, but it's only got 6 or 7. And they got a bucket you stand on when the guy... You kick the bucket out from under them when you hang them. And they got the flowers there. And as I can see, you can see right here, we got the room for the pallbearers right here in front. I'm in a lot of trouble. You can tell I've been somewhere for a long time, just looking at me. I identify with two old men that met on the street. One of them was 80-some years old. The other one was a few years younger, but a little younger. The older one said, "God," he said, "I don't know how much longer I can take it. Just," and he said, "I just ache and can't get around. And I just, how are you doing?" He said, the other one said, "I feel like a newborn baby." He said, "Really? How's that?" He said, "Well, I've got no hair. I've got no teeth. And I think I just peed in my pants." Karen, one more joke and then I'm going to quit. When you told about falling in the grave, there was a little piano player. He was pretty talented, but he was an alcoholic. And at the height of his career, he played in the big clubs and the glitzy places, you know. He always dressed in a tuxedo, really talented. But as he drank, he missed performances, and he went downhill and downhill and downhill. And finally, he wound up in this little corner bar where he was playing for drinks and little tips. And he finished his playing one night, and he was tired, and he'd had too much to drink. And there was a graveyard right across the street from his bar, and his apartment was on the other side of it, and he thought, "Hell, I'll just walk through the graveyard tonight and get home." So he started through there, and he walked into an open grave. And he couldn't get out. He cried, and he begged, and he yelled, it's like Karen did. And he was there all night long. Finally, he was just laying on the ground in his little tuxedo, still in his tux, laying on the ground looking right straight up. And every once in a while, he would say, "Help." Well, this town had another drunk. A wino was making his early morning rounds, and he heard this noise, and he came over, and he looked down into the grave, and there he laid on the bottom of the grave. And he said, "Help me. Oh, please help me." He said, "I'm so cold. Please help me." And the wino says, "Well, no wonder you've kicked off all your dirt." Thank God they got to Karen before that happened. I'm going to talk to you about alcoholism and me. I'm always amazed when I come to a conference like this or any meeting, really, to note the widely different backgrounds which we have. There's just not anything common in our backgrounds. And the doctor's opinion talks about that in our big book, that they tried to define the alcoholic personality and found that there were just too many, the exceptions ate up the rule. And the thing we have in common, however, I believe, is the fact that we have the disease. And secondly, we have a program of recovery. And these are two strong bonds for us. Old alcoholism consists of two elements, principally. One is that we are physically and mentally, second, different from our fellows. The physical difference is that when I take alcohol into my system, and those of you who are alcoholic, when you do that, it sets up a system of craving. Now, it's not like craving a cigarette. I quit smoking cigarettes before I quit drinking, and that was a different kind of craving. The kind of craving we have is you just change your mind. You decide how much you're going to drink, and you just change your mind. With me, I just did that over and over and over and over again. I just changed my mind, and when I change my mind, I take a drink, and when I take a drink, I've got way too much. And then we have an obsession of the mind. Alcoholism centers in the mind, we're told. Most of what we talk about in this program has to do with what we think about. What resentments, fears, all of those things originate in the mind, I believe. And the obsession I have is a drink would improve this situation. Whether it's a wake, a wedding, a fancy ball, a drink would improve the situation. I take the drink, I have one drink, the craving kicks in, I drink too much, and I go on and on and on that way. And I have a story I tell, and several of you have asked me to mention this tonight. I had a dog once named Patches. Patches was a wonderful dog, mostly English bulldog. He was set in his ways and ferocious in his nature. To give you an illustration of him, he had fought a badger one time on our farm. Badgers are bad news for dogs. They break their legs and then they kill them. But Patches had run across this badger and up in the field, and he had fought that badger for about 2 hours and killed him. The badger weighed one more pound than Patches did. We weighed him. Every day for a week after that little scrap, Patches would go up in the field and pick up that carcass and just shake hell out of it to warn that badger, if he was coming back, by God, if reincarnation brought him back, Patches was there and ready to go, you know. Well, Patches, on this particular day, he was a hero. Everybody in the community knew about it. He'd whipped a badger. He was well-fed. He was well-loved. He had no competition. The barnyard was his. Until the neighbor's boar hog came into the yard. And Patches made a bulldog-like decision about the hog. He made a decision to get hold of the hog. It's not a decision lightly made, and he went out there and he got hold of the hog, and it created problems in our barnyard. We hadn't had no problems before then. There was squealing, and there was growling and barking, and there was a hell of a fight going on out there, and Patches got hold of that hog and latched on and hung on. And finally, the old boar ran alongside a barn and drug him off and wheeled around, and with those long tusky head, he slashed his shoulder pretty good. And Dad came running out of the barn, and I was out there in the yard, and Mother came out to see what was happening, and we were all upset, and everybody knew the solution to this whole problem was for Patches to leave that hog alone. But we got out there and we got him pulled off the hog, and Dad gave me instructions to get some tar to put on the stop the bleeding, and we petted him and we cooled him down and put some water on him, and problem solved. So we turned him loose. And he went right back and he got hold of that hog again. And it was the same deal. It was just chaos in the barnyard every time you get hold of that damned hog. This next time, we finally got him off of him. The second time, we chained him to the water hydrant. And Dad got in the pickup and drove the hog off, so he removed temptation. And he left me the job of, I guess I was the first Hogganon counselor there was in West Texas. And I counseled him, and I petted him, and I, you know, asked him deep and penetrating questions like, did you ever have a good day getting hold of hogs? What leads you to get hold of hogs? Are hogs not nice to you? You know, I gave him a lot of time, and in about 2 hours I had cured him. He was laying on the ground. He was cool. He was relaxed. And so I went to see my father and said, "Patches is well. We had committed him. He's now committed. He's now out of treatment. I've got him going." So Dad said, "I'll look at him. He's giving me a little problem today. I'm going to take a look at him." So he walked around him two or three times, scratched his ears. Tail kept going. Everything was great. So we turned him loose. He had to go 2 miles to find the hog the next time. Some of you may identify with one of the players in this. I was the first hogging on, all right, but I switched sides. And I became a guy who went back again and again and again. The characteristic of the alcoholic in my case was I could have a lot of problems with drinking, but I persisted in going back to the alcohol. I found ways to rationalize and justify the most inane things you can imagine. I hadn't been drinking. I went to college. I didn't have a drink when I went to college. Maybe one half of a beer that blew out. Most of it came out my nose. Didn't do much for me, but I got to college and I found some guys that did a lot of that. They gave me some simple instructions, and I began to follow them. And I liked what it did, man. Did good stuff for me, but I hadn't been doing it any time at all till I was in the dean's office trying to explain why I was passed out on the band bus when I wasn't in the band. And I told this horrible story about how I was at this football game and I became ill and I thought it was some kind of flu and I began to try to search for my car and it was cold and it was windy and I was struggling up this hill and I just couldn't go anymore and there was the band bus and I got on the band bus and laid down and went to sleep. It was a tragic story that I told her. And she turned me loose on, you know, I don't know why she turned me loose, but she did. But that was just the first of many. I was always getting in trouble. And I relished it. I was raised on a farm. At 10 years old, World War II started. And I got to become a man. I got to start driving a tractor. And I drove a tractor, all I ever wanted to drive a tractor, between 10 years old and 21 years old. And I was taught responsibility. Responsibility was a big thing. Somebody's got to do it was my dad's motto. Somebody's got to do it. Might as well be you. Do it. And I was taught to work hard. And I was taught I couldn't make mistakes. You simply couldn't make mistakes. I was taught I needed to be a man. My dad gave a great example of being a man. One time he was working on a plow and he had a cold chisel in his hand and a hammer and he was trying to cut off a rusted bolt. And the chisel slipped and he hit his hand with that hammer and blood went everywhere. And Dad stood up and cussed. It's okay to cuss if you're a man. You know, that's accepted. And then he picked up that chisel and started to go back to hammering. And I said, "Daddy, did that hurt?" And he said, "Hell no." Well, a few days later, I was playing like being a man. Had a little chisel and a little hammer. Got out there on the plow and was whacking around on it. Missed the chisel. Hit my hand. Hurt like hell. And I cried. And I was afraid to hammer anymore. So I flunked being a man on three scores there. But I never could quite measure up to what my dad expected of me. And my mother was my big buddy. She helped me. And we were three people that farmed 1,500 acres during World War II. And we all worked hard. And then I found the solution to responsibility and heavy loads like that was irresponsibility. Never had a drink. And I began to do things that were totally irresponsible. Just let everybody know I wasn't trying to make the honor roll. I wasn't trying to, you know, impress anybody. I was just raising hell and running fast. And when I got to college, of course, that drink that I found fit right into it. It just worked like a charm. They just were married instantly. I gave up school. My wife said I majored in basket weaving. She knew me there. She wouldn't date me there. She had some questions about my stability. My wife has always overreacted. She just jumps to conclusions, and it's really kind of hard to deal with her sometimes. More about that later. Well, I never intended to quit drinking. I never, ever intended to give that up. I just loved it. I liked what we did. Did it with. I liked the questions, the mysteries of it. Where are we? What did we do? How are we going to get out of this? And I always had one more statement to make, and that was, let's do it again. Because I liked it. And I wasn't going to give it up, and I didn't for a long, long time. I got out of college, went to the Navy. This lady that wouldn't have much to do with me in college became a little more easier to get along with after I got out of school, and she married me. And we had a son in the Navy and went through law school and then came to Dallas. And all this time, she had a funny idea. She jumped to a conclusion that when we got married, I wouldn't drink anymore. I don't know where she got that information. I have no idea. I didn't say it. Anyway, we got to Dallas, and I was drinking pretty regularly. I could afford it a little bit now. And didn't drink much in law school because I couldn't stay up with the other guys in the class if I messed up my head. So I worked hard there. The responsible side of me kicked in. The hard work kicked in. Did well in school, and I got out of there, and I got a good job. And I began to do what I needed to do. Some other values I had were I needed to win. I used to say I needed to be a winner. Actually, what I needed was not to lose. When I lost, I was afraid you were going to kick me out. I was afraid the clients were never going to use me again. Even though I was dealing with sophisticated insurance clients a lot of times who knew about losing, but I didn't. And I can still remember most of the cases I ever lost. I can't remember many that I won. I won some, but not, you know, I just can't remember. They kind of passed away. And there was no permanence into the things I wanted. I wanted things. I knew I'd be happy if I had things. Another car. I needed two cars bad. Billy used our car all the time. That's my wife. She used our car all the time. I didn't have to take the damn bus to work or go in a carpool. It was degrading for a young lawyer like me, a comer like me, to have to let his wife use the car all the time. And I knew I'd be happy if I got two cars. Finally, one day, I got two cars. Within a week, you know what happened? I came to the conclusion and the certain knowledge that I had the wrong kind of car. I needed a little better car, a little different kind. And I chased more, better, and different about as far as you can run it. And always, always I had that empty feeling that it wasn't working. And what I treated my empty feeling with was a chemical alteration of reality. Little vacations that I would take when I picked up that bottle and just forgot about it. To hell with them all. To hell with them all except six. We'll save them for pallbearers. And I'd drink the bottle. And those episodes of drinking got closer and closer and closer together. And my wife became more and more unstable. She had a really serious emotional reaction to alcohol. She was intemperate, and she talked to me a lot about it. And I finally had to send her to a psychiatrist just to see if we couldn't loosen her up a little bit. And he told her to take some drinks and be a little more careful with money and then ask if he could see me. And we talked a little about football and a few things like that, but I drifted right away. So she went to another tax. She began the educational variety of dealing with an alcoholic. She started having me take tests. She showed me a bell curve about how you drink and how you go up the scale this way, and then you top the thing right on top, and then you start down, and there's various places you can stop on the way down, and she kind of had me marked about halfway on the downside. And she had a test, you know, and she gave me a little test, and I'm good at taking tests. I'm good enough to know that test was prescribed and written by a bunch of prohibitionists. They did not want you to drink. Nobody there was any kind of a fun person at all. But it took the damn test. And I knew I had to get some of the answers wrong. Give her a little strength there somewhere. But I came out of it with, I judge it pretty well, I came out of it as a heavy drinker, not an alcoholic. So that gave me a little more. And I don't know. My solution to getting in trouble, and I got into a lot of trouble, didn't go to jail, didn't have DWIs even. But I embarrassed myself in wrong places. I did the wrong things at the wrong time, a lot of places. It was impacting my practice of law. It certainly was impacting my marriage. My relationship with my children was going to pot. And I knew all these things were happening. And I couldn't see how that was happening. My physical health, I went to a doctor, and he told me one year that my liver function was not good at all, that I needed to cut back on alcohol. And I came back the next year, and he said, I really got to talk to you now. I said, this thing's off the chart. And he showed me how my function went off the chart. And he said, now what I want you to do is just drink. Don't drink anything for 10 days, and then come back and repeat this thing and see how you are. And I left his office with a certain knowledge that I wasn't going back. Why would I go back? If you quit drinking and it gets better, they're going to let you drink some more? Hell no. If you don't get better, is a doctor going to prescribe alcohol for a guy that's got a liver problem? No, he's not going to do that. So it wasn't any reason to go back. Now, how can you, as a sane human being, ignore that kind of thing? But I rationalized and justified my use of alcohol in that case and many, many others. My wife then began to do some very dangerous things. She overreacted. She began to do things without talking to me about them. She didn't ask my permission to do things. She didn't even tell me she was doing things. One day I asked my little daughter, where's your mother? She said, oh, I don't know, Daddy. She may have gone to one of those family meetings. I said, what kind of meeting is that, Karen? She said, I don't know, Daddy. It's just a family meeting Mommy goes to. And at this point in time, we had decided that we were not going to get along unless somebody made a radical change. And we were going to get a divorce. And if it didn't get better in 6 months, we'd just get a divorce. It occurred to me that if, under those circumstances, if my wife was going to family meetings secretly, I probably better have a representative present at those meetings. I may get the pants taken off me somewhere here, my God. I've got to be careful. So she came in. Now, my wife happens to be... She has one great skill. She's the most difficult witness I have ever cross-examined. She will not lie to you, but getting the truth out of her is like stabbing a snake with an ice pick. Man, it's really a hard thing to do. And I could tell, you know, we got to where we read each other pretty well, and I could tell when she was going to be difficult. Like this night, when she came in, I said, where have you been? She said, out. First clue, I know. Out where? To Preston Center. What did you do at the shopping center? That was in friends. Who were they? You wouldn't know them. What did you do with your friends? Oh, we just shared our experience, strength, and hope. So I saw it's going to be a long cross-examination here, so you begin to close the door so they can't go there, and close this door and get it narrower and narrower. And I got a word out of her, a word that I had never heard in my life. Al-Anon. Al-Anon. Now, things had got pretty heated by the time I got this word, Al-Anon. I had never heard Al-Anon before. And I didn't want to admit that I was ignorant of what that was. So I decided I better take my best guess at what was an Al-Anon. And I concluded that it must be some form of aluminum kitchen utensil. It isn't. And then she began to explain Al-Anon to me. I learned more in the next few minutes about Al-Anon than I ever wanted to know in my entire life. My God, the words just came rolling out of her. Gone was the neat little answers, tight little Everybody would love to be in Al-Anon. It's a wonderful program. People would, if they knew how good it was, they would pay $500 a seat just to go. People were loving and kind and thoughtful, and it was a wonderful place to go. And the only requirement for membership, was that you have a friend or family member who has a problem with alcohol. Ding! I'm the admission ticket to Al-Anon. She's taken my problem to a public meeting. She said anybody could go. My God. I've just made partner in the largest law firm in Dallas. And my wife is going to public meetings proclaiming that I'm... No, tell them what the hell she's told me. And I said, I got sober almost instantly. And I sat her down and I said, Billy, listen carefully. This is serious. She said, okay. I said, have you noticed that I am the only one who brings any money to this house? Yeah. She said, I've noticed that. I said, you know, we have a lot of bills to pay. Yeah. And you know, we have bills to pay because we bought things on credit, like a house, a car, furniture, all kinds of things. Yes, she knew that. I said, do you know that when you stop paying those things, what happens? She said, what happens? I said, they come and get those things. Now, if they find out downtown that you are going to public meetings proclaiming that I'm an alcoholic, they will fire me that day. The money will stop. We're talking about you and I and our children standing naked on the streets of Dallas in the middle of December. You got to quit going to those damn meetings. This is very serious. And she got that kind of Al-Anon look on her face and said, I think I need to go. I said, Billy, don't go to any more of those meetings. They're going to find out downtown and I'm going to lose my job. It'll be hard to find another one. I won't be able to take any clients with me. Don't go to those meetings. And she said, Jerry, I really do need to go to those meetings. And then I said something loving like, well, if you go to another one, I'll kill you just sure as hell. When reason fails, four steps in, you know, that's always the way it is. And she just looked at me, and she didn't quit going. She didn't. Boy, when they get them for a little while, it's hard to get them out of there, I'll tell you that. Now, I spent a lot of time thinking about how to get her out of there. I tried everything I could think of. Every day I drove to work, and I wondered, is today the day they're going to call me in and say, we understand your wife is going to public meetings saying that you're an alcoholic. That's not good for the reputation of this firm. And they were going to, next thing was going to be, you're fired. And on the way home, and they hadn't said anything that day, I'd come out thinking, God, I got by another day. I've got to get that woman out of Al-Anon. I got to get her out of there. And I'd try every damn thing I could think of. I tried to beg her out of it. I tried to threaten her out of it. I tried everything I could think of. One night, I don't know, you guys probably don't do that, but I picked fights. I was just going to make it so damned unpleasant she'd quit. And the way you'd pick a fight like that when you're in that frame of mind is you don't tell them you're going to be a fight. Not right away. You kind of ooch into the fight, gathering information that'll be helpful to your cause as you go along until you get all the good stuff you can get from them, and then you start throwing it back. And so I went in, and I gave her a little kiss on the cheek, and she was cooking dinner, and I said, oh, it smells good. We're going to have a nice dinner tonight. Yes, we are. How are the kids? Kids are good. How's the dog? Dog all right? Yeah, dog's good. Everything's fine. And I said, Billy, I've been thinking. You believe I'm an alcoholic. And she said, I don't know whether you are or not. I said, well, that's damn funny. You've called me an alcoholic for years. And she said, yes, but I was wrong. It doesn't matter what I think. It doesn't matter what your mother and father think, what your partners think, what your doctor thinks. It doesn't matter at all what anybody in the world thinks except what you think. If you don't think you've got a problem with alcohol, you'll never do anything about it. And I made a mistake. This was a totally unexpected answer. I was off balance. No good trial lawyer does what I did next, which was ask a question in the middle of a heated controversy when he does not know the answer. And I said, well, if I wanted to find out if I was an alcoholic, how would I do it? The jaws of the Al-Anon trap closed just like that. She had me. I really wanted to know. I really wanted to know. Her response to me was a complete reversal. And here, I wanted to know. I kind of wondered about it, you know, sort of. I didn't know anybody that drank like I did. As I made mistakes and screwed up in Dallas, the thing I did is I quit going to wherever that happened. And you drink as long as I did in Dallas, you're not a lot of places you go. I stayed at home mostly and drank at home. My green chair. And she said, well, there's a lady named Marty Mann, who was the first woman member of Alcoholics Anonymous, who has written a book called The Primer on Alcoholism. I've read that book. And in that book, she says, if you want to find out if you're an alcoholic, what you should do is try some controlled drinking. And I said, what the hell is that? And she said, that's where you decide that you're going to only drink 2 drinks a day, but you're going to drink every day 2 drinks. And if you can do that for 6 months, you are not an alcoholic. I said, wait a minute. Do I understand, after all this time, you want me to continue drinking for 6 months? She said, yes. And I realized I was dealing with a very sick woman. This conversation was not going my way at all, and I broke off the conversation and went and sat in my chair. I sat in my chair for off and on for a couple of weeks thinking about this thing. Told her it was the dumbest test I'd ever heard. Didn't want to hear any more about it. But I kept thinking about it. And that sense of responsibility that I had as a kid kicked in. And I began to think, you know, somebody's got to save this damn family. She ain't going to do it. She's going to go to that damn Al-Anon this year as the world till I'm kicked out of the legal profession and we're broke. That's what's going to happen. I guess I'm going to have to take the damn test. You can pass the test, can't you? Well, hell yes, I can pass that test. There's nothing to that test. I won't particularly like the test, but I can do all right with it. So I didn't tell her I'm going to take the test because she watched me drink all the time. She knew how much I drank every day. I was doing it right there in the house. And decided I'd just take the test, and she'd watch me, and in a few months, probably wouldn't have to go 6 months. She'd realize what a fool she'd made of herself, and she would quit going to Al-Anon, confess her wrong to me. Now, I had to change the test a little bit. 2 drinks didn't do me any good, but I had a pretty good-sized glass, and so I decided I'd do 3 drinks. I would have 2 drinks, loosely called martinis, before dinner. Sometimes they had a little vermouth in them. That's why I said loosely. Mostly they were gin. And I would have 2 of those before dinner. Then I would eat. And after dinner, I would have a brandy in that same glass with just a little splash of soda. And then I would switch to coffee. And if I wanted anything else to drink that evening, I would drink coffee. And that was my plan. And I started doing that plan, and that plan was the initial step in my recovery. For the first time in my life, I found out I didn't drink what I wanted to drink. I always assumed that I drank what I wanted to drink. I was drinking about 1/4 a day, and sometimes I wondered why I did that. But seemed like a good idea at the time, and so I just thought that's what I wanted to drink. But as I started this test, I would have 1 drink, and the second drink would begin. I'd be getting toward the bottom of the second drink, you know. And I would, the cares of the day would be kind of sliding off my chest, and I stepped out of the phone book, you know. Here he comes to save the day. I hear the music in the background, da 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 da, and a thought would come to me. What are you doing? What are you doing? Are you over 21? Are you a man? Who supports all these damn people here? Who has to go downtown and fight those other damn lawyers all day long, and the irresponsible and loose judges that we have, and the bad clients that I have to represent? Who has to go down and get all that pressure dumped on them day after day after day? Are you going to let a bunch of little old ladies in tennis shoes tell you how to drink whiskey? And the answer is, hell no, I'm not. Hell no. And I'd go drink the bottle. Or I could go and I would go to the bar, and I'd had a bad day. And I'd walk up to the bar, and I'd look at the bar for a minute, and I'd think, you know, I've had a bad day. It's been a bad day. Ain't going to be no damn test today. And I'd drink the bottle. And then, there were days when I could forget the damn test. But then her sponsor, God, she had a brutal sponsor. This woman knew the inside of the alcoholic mind like you couldn't believe. And she told Billy that she wanted her to start the day on a spiritual note. The moment she awakened, the instant she became conscious, she was to say out loud and firmly, "This is the day the Lord has made. I shall rejoice and be glad in it." Now, when you're in bed with a woman, having had a quart of whiskey the night before, and you hear that, and you wake up to that, your head's throbbing, one of your eyes has been propped open for several hours, and it's pretty dry. Got a thick stuff on your tongue that you could shave, you know. And you hear that, you're reasonably sure you'll not rejoice a lot that day. And you don't want anybody else to rejoice either, by God. And I fought that deal. My God, I tried everything. I gave that test a reasonable chance. I ran it for a year and a half. Never passed her one time. Not one. And then came along December 31, 1972. I had a bad December. I had got out and got drunk, and it had been real hard to get me home a time or two. I had embarrassed myself. We didn't have many friends left that we were doing anything, and my wife set up a deal with two other couples, and we were going to come to my house and go out to have dinner, and then we're going to come back to my house and bring in the new year. And I knew why we're doing it this way. We're doing it this way because if Jerry gets out somewhere in a nightclub or a restaurant and begins to drink, there's no telling when we'll get him home. So the thing we have to do is work around Jerry, and we'll get him a couple drinks, get him out and get him fed, and then bring him home. And this is my wife's thinking. And then we'll be here. We may lock the doors, but he'll stay here. So I got up on December 31st and decided I'd have a little drink, just, you know, to kind of bring the day in. It wasn't working. And she saw me mixing it, and she said, "You know, Jerry, we're going out to dinner." I said, I know. I got it. No problem. I'm going to pace myself. I didn't tell her that, but I'm pacing myself. And so I paced myself through the day. And then I woke up in my green chair, and I looked out the window, and it was pitch black. And I looked over, and Billy was sitting in her chair in a robe, reading a little book. They read lots of little books. They distribute literature also. They leave literature all over the damned house. And I said, "Billy, shouldn't we be getting dressed to go to dinner?" She said, "Oh, Jerry, don't you know what time it is?" And I looked at the clock. It was about 10:15. I'd passed out at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. I wasn't mad at anybody. I hadn't been to a party. I had no reason on earth to be passed out at 5 o'clock He had had to call those people and tell them that we couldn't go to dinner. I also knew she had to tell them, I don't think it's a good idea for you all to come over here tonight. And she probably said, Jerry's passed out in his chair. And I was sick of me. I was sick of what I was, what I had become. And I went to the bar and got my big glass and had one big drink. I wanted oblivion, and I got it. And I woke up on January the 1st, 1973, to the sorriest looking day I've ever seen in my life. And I sat on the bed, edge of the bed that morning. Billy was up, already gone. And I realized what I'd done the night before and what had happened, and I was ashamed of myself. I wasn't supposed to be that kind of guy. I wasn't supposed to be that irresponsible. And I sat there and I thought, what are you going to do this year? You wore out 1972. Now, what the hell are you going to do with 73? What are your options? What are your options? You can't pass that damn test. The only thing you haven't tried in your whole life about alcohol is something you promised you would never, ever do. But that morning, it didn't seem like such a bad idea. So I took a shower and cleaned myself up as much as I could, and I went through, got to the kitchen and told Billy that I was sorry for what I'd done the night before. She was not impressed with my apology whatsoever. And then I said, I'm going to try to quit drinking. And she was impressed. She said, would you like for me to call someone from Alcoholics Anonymous? And she ran over to the bookcase and grabbed two books. One was a dark blue book that you all have seen a lot of, like that one right down there. She just happened to have one of those. And then she had a little 24-hour-a-day book. And she came running over and gave them to him. She said, you want me to call the people from AA? And I took the books and threw them against the wall and said, hell no. I got myself in this deal, and by God, if anybody get me out, it'll be me. Self-reliance. West Texas man. And she said something loving and out of line like, you got it, and walked off. And I had it. I didn't know I had it, but I had it. I don't know how it was when you quit drinking. If you're doing something bad for yourself and you stop, shouldn't it get better? Didn't get better. I got the quick. I was in the wrong place all the time. If I was sitting down, I ought to be standing up. If I'm standing up, I ought to be walking. If I'm walking, I ought to be outside. If I'm outside, I ought to be inside laying down. And God, I'm just moving and grooving all through the day. Couldn't sleep at night. Can you believe that? Couldn't sleep at night. Sweat. It's January 1st. It's colder than hell, and I'm sweating all over. And the second day, it wasn't getting any better. I knew she'd leave those books somewhere. So I waited till she got in the back of the house somewhere, and I sneaked in there and I grabbed the little 24-hour-a-day book. It's not conference approved, and I'm sorry I didn't have time to read the conference approved literature. But this was sort of emergency information that I was trying to suggest here. I wanted to find out what the hell them AA and AAs did, by God, to deal with this kind of problem. And I opened it up, and with that keen alcoholic mind, I noticed there was a date in each corner, and I went to January the 2nd. And it said, alcohol has ruined your life. And I said, hell yes. You got it, cowboy. What else? And then it said, this year we're going to give our drinking problem to God and leave it there. I've never been as disappointed in anything in my life. I've got an industrial grade problem and they're giving me Sunday school crap here. I've been to all kinds of churches. I've been to talk to ministers and priests and all kinds of people, and I couldn't get it. I'm a spiritual mongrel. I can't find a home. I've been looking for a home since I was a little kid, and I wanted something big to happen to convince me that there was something really there. Let me walk on a little water or start a burning flower right there, just flamer, just for a minute. Let me know that this is not a bunch of hocus pocus. I was born cynical. And I was born skeptical. Prove it to me. Prove it to me. And I kept saying to God, prove it to me. It doesn't work that way. And I don't know why I did what I did next. But I tossed that little book out in the middle of the table, closed my eyes and said, God, if you're there, I'm going to give you this drinking problem. And if you take it, I may do a little more business with you. Probably this most serious prayer I ever said. I really needed help. I was honest, and I asked for help. I didn't direct what the help might be. I just wanted help. Nothing happened. I woke up the next morning knowing without any question at all, if I don't get some help today, I'm going to drink. I was knotting up. My stomach was knotting up. I was sweating. I don't know whether I was having hallucinations or not, but I was not doing well, I'll tell you that. And I decided that I needed some help with skin on it. I didn't need anything wishy-washy like spiritual stuff. I wanted some skin on it. I wanted some people to talk to me. And I couldn't find them. Didn't know who I could ask. But I remember this AA thing, and I thought, well, hell, I'll try them. Now, I couldn't call the group where my wife had been going. She'd poisoned the well there. Hell, I wasn't going to have to overcome that, but then drinking too. So I called the central office, and I got the most unsympathetic human being on the telephone you've ever heard in your life. It was a woman, always a woman that disappoints me. I told her, I said, I'm trying to quit drinking, and I'm having a little trouble. She said, really? And I said, yeah. Yeah. She said, are you going to AA meetings? And I said, no, ma'am. She said, you need to go to an AA meeting every day. I said, oh, no, ma'am. I'm a very busy and, you know, fairly important lawyer, and I can't afford that kind of time. And she said, well, what have you been doing in the evening? I said, well, like I said, I've been drinking. She said, well, you're going to stop that, so you're going to have some free time, aren't you? So I realized I was dealing with another unreasonable person. So I said, where should I go to meetings? And so she said, where would you like to go? And I said, I don't know where there is. I can't go to that Preston place. I can't go there. My wife goes to Al-Anon there, and I can't go there. She said, what kind of place would you like to go? She said, well, I'd like to go to a place, you know, near a country club that's mostly made up of college graduates, you know, secret. I want it really secret. I don't want anybody to know what we're doing there. And then she said, we ain't got none of them. And, so I said, what do you got? So we settled on a little home group. That seemed to me to be the best place for me to go where I wouldn't see many people. And so she gave me the name of it. It had a nice name, Town and Country Group. Kind of woodsy, you know, and I thought everybody drove station wagons, and it'd be in a nice neighborhood. They met in homes. And so I went to that, and God, they had years of sobriety. I mean, they were serious about this damn thing. If they ever had a drinking problem. When a guy tells you he hadn't had a drink in 5, 15, 20 years, you think he ever had my kind of problem? I'm barely hanging on by my damn fingernails here, and they're talking to me about all these. Their baby had a year and a half, and I was not doing well there. They went once a week, whether they needed it or not. And then the miracle happened. A guy walked in from South Dakota. He had been in a place called Heartview. Been there for a long time. Something about not doing an inventory. But he came out, he finally did it, and he came to that meeting that night. I don't know, he talked to a minister somewhere who knew about the little meeting. Came walking into that meeting, had literature sticking out of every pocket. And he sat down in that meeting, and he knew more about alcoholism than anybody I had ever heard in my life. He had 6 months of glorious sobriety, and he was still quick. And we looked at each other in that meeting. We knew we were dealing with real alcoholics. And after the meeting, I followed him right outside and I said, David, what do you think about this AA? He said, "That's not for us." He said, we're going to need to go to a meeting every night. We're going to have to get in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous if we are going to survive. And the magic happened for me because I said, where are we going to go? A guy from out of town, he said, well, there's a new little group I've heard about. The other place the minister told me about was a little group that's starting way out on Alpha Road, way out in North Dallas. And it's upstairs over a 7-Eleven store, which is a convenience store in our area. And he said, I'm going there tomorrow night. Will you go with me? I said, I'll have to think about that. And so he said, well, I hope to see you there. And we left. So the next day, I cased the place, just like I was going to rob it. The first time I drove past it, I drove by it about 55 miles an hour and just glanced at it. I did not want to arouse suspicion. I made the block and I came in and I turned in and I parked in front of the 7-Eleven store and went inside and got a Slurpee or whatever the hell you buy in 7-Eleven stores. As I went in, I looked up to that second floor and to see if there were any kind of surveillance cameras or spies sitting up there watching to see who's showing up. It was clear. I checked it again when I came out, and it was clear again. Two good signs. And then I got in my car and backed up, and I noticed there was a driveway around the side of the building. So I drove around the side of the building, and there it was. There were six parking places in the alley. I could climb the fire escape and go to Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the way you got me. Full of doubt, full of all kinds of reservations, totally frustrated with life. Had no idea how I could stay sober. If you can't get by on three drinks a day, how in the hell are you going to get by on none? I didn't ever tell anybody that I was worried about whether I could stop or not, because that wouldn't be manly. Hell yes, I could stop. And I didn't tell them I was going to have trouble staying stopped. I just showed up. Just as the meeting started, I walked in, and just as the meeting ended, I went out. But they grab you and hug you. They were bad about that, terrible about that. And they ask you questions. How are you feeling? Feel fine. Toes don't hurt. Knees don't hurt. Everything's fine. What step are you working on? I don't quite know yet. Have you got a sponsor? Not yet. And this one girl, I kept going to that damn meeting. And you know, the interesting thing about those people, they didn't ask if I was a lawyer or if I was a doctor or if I was a truck driver. They didn't give a damn what I was. That was the first question I always ask anybody. What do you do? And they didn't care. They acted like they liked me. They acted like they wanted me to come back. They told me they did. They told me things about themselves that were just astounding. A guy would stand up behind the podium and tell the worst things about himself you ever heard in your life. And the audience would just laugh like hell. They had the most inappropriate sense of humor I had ever seen in my life. Now, I'm competitive if I'm nothing else. And I got to thinking, well, you know, I did a couple of things that were kind of cute. I might tell them. And I did. And they laughed. And they put their arms around me and said, looky here. Jerry is beginning to open up. He's beginning to be himself. They told me that being myself, acting within my own values, was the greatest freedom I would ever have. I didn't really know what my values were. If you had asked me when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, is alcohol more important than your family? I would have passed a lie detector test when I said no. No, it's not more important. How about your profession? No, of course not. Not even close. How about your job? Not a chance. But I'd risk. I risk my family. I risk my profession. I put my job on the line every time, every day I drank. Had no idea. listening to or about. These people presented to me in their actions a different kind of approach to life. And I began to like it. I began to identify with those people. One of the worst ones was a girl. She's a woman about my age, I guess, and maybe a little older, I'm not sure. She was loud, and she was wild talking, and she'd grab you and hug you at the drop of a hat, and she made me very nervous. And one night she said, Jerry said, I want you to go out with me to have ice cream after the meeting. And I said, oh, what does that woman want with me, for God's sake? And she said, I want to talk to you. Will you go? And I said, well, yeah, I guess so. So she told me where to go to get ice cream. She told me what kind of ice cream to have, where to sit. And she's bossy as hell. And she said, some bitch, I've been watching you. She said, I think you're going to make it. She said, I want to make it too. She said, I was sober 13 years, and I got drunk, and I got on marijuana and Valium and anything I could get. Now, for 4 years, she said, I just lived in hell. They finally sent me out of town just to get rid of me. And I went to a treatment center, and I came back, and I've got about 6 or 8 months now. I've forgotten the exact date. She said, I need someone who is tough enough to tell me when I'm getting off the beam, when I'm making mistakes. I think you could do that. Would you do that for me? I said, I damn sure will. She said, good, because that's what I'm going to do for you. My life began to change. A little while after I had been sober, a woman came to my door that I had been involved in some civil rights projects with. Really a great gal. She got cancer of the tongue. And that just made my skin crawl to think about that. And she had had to drop out everything, and she'd gone to have some cold therapy somewhere in Seattle, I believe it was. And she came back unannounced and knocked on my door. And we had a little ritual. Anytime we got together, she'd say, let's have a drink. And she walked in that night and she said, let's have a drink. And I walked to the bar. And as I walked to the bar, I thought, are you going to have a drink? What kind of a man would you be not to have a drink with a good friend like this? What kind of a man are you? And then I had another voice in my head, another thought. Jerry, you don't want to drink. You want the bottle. You want oblivion. You want away from this situation. So I mixed her a light drink because it would burn her tongue, she said. And I mixed myself a soda of some kind. And after that was over, I thought about it. You know, that's unusual for me to do that. A little later, my wife and I were trying to put this marriage back together. She heard about a Baptist retreat out in East Texas. She wanted to go. So, young Baptist minister who had written a book of some kind about marriage was holding this retreat. And we went out there, and we had dinner, and got in this room. There were about 10 couples. And they sat around the floor on this one room, and the minister stood out in the middle of the room. I'm a Methodist, by the way, and I don't do things like Baptists do. And he said, well, let's get this evening started off, this weekend started off right. He said, let's go around the room and everybody tell me what God is doing for them in their life today. That's a testimonial. Baptists are bad about giving testimonials. Methodists don't give testimonials. I was not going to give a testimonial. I was not even going to sit in that room. I didn't think, but then I realized my wife is, when I get up here and crawl out of this room on my hands and knees or whatever I've got to do to get to that door over there, she ain't coming. I'm going to be out there all by myself. She's going to sit there, and it just sure as the world, she's going to stay there. So I thought, well, somebody will pass. Somebody will say pass. So I'll just listen to them for a little while. And they began to go around the room, and they were all civilians, no alcoholics or up. People like that. Civilians have little bitty problems. They couldn't drive Central Expressway without God. Well, I drove Central Express, right? Drunker and Cooter Brown. They couldn't work without God. I'd work with my God. What do you mean? Couldn't raise their kids. I raised my kids fine. I just couldn't identify with anything they were doing. They had little old wimpy problems. And I got to thinking, gee, my knee. If these Baptists knew that they had a real alcoholic sitting in this room who hadn't had a drink for 3 months, and I guess it's because of God. I guess that's what it is. Why? I'd blow the socks off these damn Baptists. They would want to counsel with me after this meeting was over. I'm sure of that. And I might have some things to teach them. So I didn't hear anything for quite a while now. This probably never happened to you, but I was rehearsing my speech. And I didn't hear anything for a long time. And it came around the room till it got to a real pretty little girl. She was slender. She had gray eyes. My mother had gray eyes. And I'd noticed her eyes, and she stood up. Well, no, she didn't stand up first. Her husband stood up first. He was a big old boy, 6'4", 250 pounds, had calluses on the back of his hands from dragging the ground. You know, you've seen that kind of. Looked like he could whip King Kong left-handed, you know. And he began to bawl and blubber and blow his nose, and you couldn't understand a damn thing he was saying. I didn't know what the hell he was talking about. I just wanted him to sit down, for God's sake. You're embarrassing me. You're bound to be embarrassing your wife. Just sit down. And so finally he did. And then she got up. And she looked around and made eye contact with everybody in that room. And she said, I couldn't do it without God. I couldn't do it without God. He sustains me. On a daily basis, he sustains me. And the nicest thing, said, it's really hard. It's really hard. She said, you've seen my husband. He can't hardly handle it. But somebody, someday he's going to find another person to go through this life with him. My children are 2 or 3 years old. They haven't found God yet. It's too young for them to find God. But there'll be an opportunity for them to find God somewhere down the line. And they'll have a chance to find this power that I enjoy every day. She was a 32-year-old woman, and she was dying of cancer. She had the most beautiful countenance on her. She was handling a little smile on her face. And I had, the big book talks in one place about a great thought. I'd been really feeling sorry for myself. I was giving up the white tablecloths and the long stem drinks, martinis. I called them deep dish green olive pies. You know, they were good things. And she was handling this thing. And the thought came to me, you know, if she had your solution to her problem, the doctor said, I'm going to take both of your legs as well. She would have said, I'll take it, just like that. And the voice came to me again and said, ain't you got it tough, cowboy? Ain't you got it tough? You've been sitting around here sucking your thumb, feeling sorry for yourself. If that little lady had your solution, she'd be the happiest person in the world. All you've got to do is go to those meetings, deal with those nice people you've met, and you can go anywhere and do anything that God ever intended for you to do. Ain't you got it tough? I did not make a talk that night. I don't know how I got out of that room. Don't have any idea how I got out of that room. All I remember next is I was outside walking in those pine trees out there in East Texas. Tears streaming down my cheeks. My nose was running. I was bawling like a baby. I made that old boy look like he was really in control of his life. But I wasn't crying out of sadness. I had switched from self-pity to gratitude in a matter of one or two sentences, this girl said. I had moved into reality. And reality let me know I was in the right place. To me, that's a spiritual experience. It was a good one for me. I did all the steps. I found things about myself I didn't know existed. Self-centeredness. Self-centeredness. I wasn't self-centered. I gave money to the church. I supported my family. How in the hell could I be self-centered? I wasn't self-centered. So I skipped that part of the book. And then I began to catch on to little things. I noticed some things about myself. You probably don't have this happen, but I have a lane of traffic that is my lane. What happens in my lane of traffic is my business. When somebody pulls in front of me in my lane of traffic, they do that to me. Somebody has to punish people like that. And like my dad said, somebody's got to do it. So that was my job. Some people wouldn't speak to me. If I didn't like them, I didn't give a damn. If they were a friend of mine and they didn't speak to me, I wondered, what in the hell did I do to them? Everything I did in my life was how it affected me. What I thought was important in life were those things that I thought did affect me. The rest of it was kind of trash that I didn't have to worry about. I was living a totally self-centered life, and I found that in that fourth step. Fear. My life was shot through with fear. I wanted to be a winner. Hell, I didn't want to be a loser because I feared that I wouldn't measure up to you. I was operating on a set of values that had no permanence whatsoever, had no substance whatsoever. I was dealing totally in a material world with a spiritual illness, and it won't work. And I began to reexamine my life and look at things and try to live in a little different plane. Alcoholics Anonymous told me what was important, told me what I needed to do to try to do God's will in my life, to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. That's what I said I would do in the third step, and the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous were the first way that God wanted me to do, first things He wanted me to do. So I did them. The best I could do them, I did them. I didn't much want to do a fifth step. I mean, it's okay to write it down. I don't mind doing that. I can hide it and lock it up in the safe. It's not that big a deal, but I don't want to tell anybody about it. So I went to my sponsor. I didn't go often to my sponsor. Just occasionally I went to see him, and I said, did you find it necessary to do a fourth step? He said, well, hell yes. I didn't. I said, oh. Well, did you find it necessary to do a fifth step? Oh, yeah. Yeah, he said, did it. I said, tell me how that happened. He said, well, I went to my sponsor, and my sponsor gave me a date, and I finished my fourth step, and I went over there, and I sat down with him, and he said, is that little book you got, is that your fourth step? And I said, yes, it was. He said, may I see it? And I gave it to him, and he threw it in the trash can. He said, that's the past. That's gone. Now we're going to talk about your future. Well, I thought, now, if his sponsor did that way with him, probably he would do the same thing with me, wouldn't he? Doesn't that make sense? Is that logical? Well, that's what we did. I said, oh, would you do mine with me? And he said, yeah, he would. And I went to see him. And I went in. When I got it all written down, and it was a hot piece of property, I mean, tell you. I went in and I sat down at his desk, and I was holding this thing. He said, is that it? And I said, that's it. It's written in a little red notebook. And he said, may I see it? And I said, yeah, I guess so. And I began to look around for the trash can because we're going to need one here in just a minute. And he said, well, do you want to read this to me or do you want me to read it to you? And I was just like old Job in the Bible. That which I feared had come upon me. My God. So I had him read it. And for the next period of time, I stood up on the other side of the desk and said, right now, right there, that's a little overstated. But I got through it. And when I got through with it, I went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I walked in and I looked around and I thought, by God, I paid my dues. And it wasn't necessary anymore for me to bluff, to tell people I never had fear. Because somebody knew. And you can't bluff when somebody knows what your hole card is. And my life continued to unfold. Remarkable things happened to me. I changed so much that a guy stopped me in a bait shop in Colorado, fly shop, and said, are you Jerry Jones? I said, well, hell yes, Bill. We'd been on a church board together. We'd done a lot of things together. He was a veterinarian, took care of my dogs. And I said, yeah, hell yeah. He said, what happened to you? I said, well, I got a few more miles, a couple of dents, but, you know, not much. You're not angry anymore. You're not angry anymore. Now tell me what that is. And he led me right outside and made me sit down and tell him what happened to me in my life. My mother called me. She had had cancer. She got cancer before I got sober. And I love my mother a lot. She was a big part of my life. I love my father too, but he and I were always after each other. We were competitors in a way. She was always on my side. And she didn't approve of what I did when I drank. I was a big disappointment to her. And I knew it. And she told me that I was ruining my life and my family. She said, you gotta do something about this, Jerry. And I've got a photograph of she and I taken 6 days before I got sober. And I looked, I'm swollen and blimped up and I'm the unhappiest looking son that you ever saw in your life. And my mother doesn't look a bit happier than I am. She had this cancer and it was an ovarian cancer and they operated and thought they got it all. And then it came right back in a little while. And she called me and said, I've got to have another surgery. Would you come up and be with me while I have that? And I said, you bet. And I went up there and I didn't take my bottle. I didn't take a bottle of whiskey. Never traveled without a bottle of whiskey, but she didn't. She died with 75 years of continuous sobriety. She was not much impressed with the need for alcohol. And I went up there and for that second operation, and they started that operation. I didn't drink for a day, and the old family doctor observed the surgery, and they hadn't been in there any time, didn't see me like, and he came walking out, and he said, boys, it ain't no good. That cancer's everywhere. She won't last a year. And it was as though somebody turned a switch. All the resolve I had, all the resolution I'd made about not drinking, all that stuff just went away. And I turned around, walked out, got in a car, went to a liquor store, and bought a bottle. And for a few days, I was up there pouring vodka and coffee and trying to play like I was sober. She got out of recovery, and she was in her room, and she knew I was drunk. Everybody knew I was drunk. And they sent me home because I was of no use to anybody when I was 5 years sober. The first thing I did when I got sober is I sent a copy of the book Alcoholics Anonymous to my mother and father and told them that I knew I was a disappointment to them. And this was the way I was going to try to live the rest of my life. My mother, my dad's eyes were gone by that time, and she read that book to him. And they thought Alcoholics Anonymous was the best thing that the world had ever invented. They really liked it. They went to every meeting with me that they could go to. And my mother, when I went up, she got it the second time, we were at ease. We were at peace and ease. And I went up there. She said, well, it's been a long time, Jerry. We've been fighting this thing for about 17 years, and they found another lump in my stomach. Would you come up? And I said, you bet you, I'll be there. And I went up there and sat and talked to her for a little bit. And she said, get the family in here. I want to talk to them. So I rounded up everybody that was at the hospital there. And she said, folks, this ain't going to be pretty. It's going to be easy. I've been fighting this a long time, and I'm a lot weaker than I was when I started. And I don't know whether I'm going to make this one or not. I'm going to try. I'm going to give it my best shot, but I don't know whether I'm going to make it or not. It's going to be hard on me. But, she said, it's going to be hard on you too. This is not going to be a quickie. This is likely to take a little time. And while this is going on, you can lean on Jerry. He'll be your strength. And it was. She died after a couple of weeks of really bad pain and very unpleasant circumstances. And my dad blew a big ulcer and they had to move most of his stomach. I had the funeral arrangements I had to make. He didn't get to go to the funeral. And it was after that it was all settled down that it occurred to me that not one time had I ever thought about taking a drink. Not once. Never even crossed my mind. Same man, same mother, same circumstance. Something had been added to my life. I don't keep that, whatever that is, added to my life all the time. Alcoholics Anonymous is designed to be an ongoing program. You don't fix it once and get it fixed. It's something we've got to process daily, the rest of our lives. Things happen that we don't like. I got cancer a little while back. for leukemia. They didn't know what they could do for me. A new drug came along, and it's been doing well for me. While that was going on, and while I never have known whether I'm going to last another week or another year, I don't have any idea how long this medicine's going to work. After 2 years, I got prostate cancer, and they had to operate for that. And I don't know whether that's coming back or not either. They don't think it is, but we don't know. And I spent a lot of time thinking about the hereafter. Spent a lot of time thinking about what's going to happen to me, which is a very selfish thought. And I remembered my old buddy Bob White. He's gone now, but his memory lingers on. I went to him one time and I said, "Bob, I've just about got it figured out." And he said, "What's that, sugar boy?" He said, I said, "I figured out my most basic fear." He said, "What's that?" I said, "It's a fear that I will cease to exist as an entity. Jerry Jones will no longer exist. I hear the spiritual people talking about we're all drops of water going back into the ocean. Hell, I don't want to go in the ocean. I want to stay a drop of water." And he just laughed. And he said, I said, "What do you think about death, Bob?" And he said, "Well, I'll tell you what I think about it." He said, "My wife, Marceline, who was Linda's sponsor, said she brings a new guru in here about every week to talk in a little chapel. Said they got the damnedest ideas you ever heard in your life about what's going to happen when we die. Every one of them's got a little different idea." And he said, "I don't want to be morbid, but I can't hardly wait till it happens to see who's right." And said, "Guess what? If nothing happens, I won't know it. And why in the hell should I worry about it?" And I remember that one day, and I thought, I'm not going to spend another day of this life. I'm not going to ruin another day worrying about what may happen to ruin what's going to happen this day. We have been given a magnificent gift. We have been given something that most people never have a chance for. There are thousands of drunks out there that never get our chance of being in a meeting in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's our responsibility to find them and get them in here. That's our job. That's our purpose. That's our meaning for life. And if we don't respond to it, it ain't ever going to happen. And they're growing them faster out there than we can sober them up. I hope next year you all are covered up with new drunks. Because they're there, ripe for the plucking. And don't worry about, some people say, "I can't do that because I don't go 12-step because I might screw somebody up." You can't screw up a drunk. You can't. They're already screwed up. Get them in a meeting. Get them in a meeting. Let the magic work for them. We've been given a great gift that we didn't deserve. A great gift that is probably as good a gift as ever been given to mankind. A program that puts us in touch with the power greater than ourselves. That solves all of our problems if we will use it. Ain't we got it tough? Thank you.